We've been waiting for this for so. We are not in the last one, but we're gonna do it. We're gonna go all the way. I know we can do it.
We're feeling confident, excited.
Like our chances.
But I think that we have it. The Dutch aren't the Dutch of old, and I think we got it. 1-0.
2-0 USA.
We're going to win 3-0.
2-1 USA.
2-1. 2-1 USA.
2-1 Yanks. I'm feeling it.
Yep. 1-0 USA.
100%. We believe that we can win.
100%. Go USA!
USA! USA! USA! USA! USA!
Americas, live and underway here on ESPN Plus as we bring you more beautiful images of the Qatari capital, Doha, in the immediate aftermath of a round of 16 showdown between the United States and Netherlands at Khalifa International Stadium. The Dutch in the end, Herc, winners by a final score of 3-1. Been a while since we got to see the U.S. in knockout round action. At the World Cup, I thought you were tense during the group phase. You were even more fired up to watch this one.
No, not fired up. A little disappointed.
Really?
Yeah.
But even during the game, I could sense, like, you really, really wanted this team to win. All that talk of, like, free hit, free roll. Once a game starts, and I think probably the fans felt that, too.
It's not that I wanted them to win.
You believe they could.
Well, I realistically did believe they had a fighting chance, mm-hmm. and that's what made it even more disappointing. Mm-hmm. It's the way they go out. I knew it was over once everybody started agreeing with me.
Right.
Once
right.
the FC panel, once the Picante panel yep. started going, you know what, you convinced me. I started thinking to myself, this is way too easy. It's not going to go down this way. And I got that feeling the first 15 minutes of watching the game. The posture from both teams,
right.
it left me a little unsettled.
Yeah, it was very interesting, kind of in the 24 hours leading into this match. How many people that we talked to around, and you heard it from our colleague over at ESPN Netherlands, Pascal Kamperman, he called it 50-50. Our colleagues at ESPN Argentina, ESPN Mexico, everybody said, hey, the U.S.
FC guy, Shaka Craig.
Really yeah. has a shot here. Frank LeBeouf had
it. Oh, that was over once Frank
yeah,
picked the U.S.
Yeah, right. He had the U.S. to win in penalties. Unfortunately, it does not go down that way. So we're going to cover this from every angle. We got Casey Keller, who's going to be joining us in just a little bit. We got Alexis Nunez, who's live outside the stadium. She, of course, will bring us the fan perspective. We're also going to break it down from a tactical perspective with El Profe, Juan Carlos Osorio. But Herc, let's just get your first raw reactions as the U.S. are out in the round of 16.
My first raw reaction is, yes, this Netherlands team is better man for man. Mm-hmm. There is no argument about that. Where they play, their curriculums, ceiling, whatever you want, they're just better man for man. I think it's evident. But even more so when we talk about the coaching. Louis van Gaal ate Greg Berhalter's lunch.
Why? What specifically?
Louis van Gaal and this Netherlands team never wanted to run with the United States men's national team. Frankie de Jong, De Roon, they're not going to run with Weston McKennie, with Tyler Adams, Yunus Musah. They know that's the strength of this core, of this team. They never wanted that. Mm-hmm. But they knew that they weren't good enough to beat them on the ball with their quality. So while Greg Berhalter planted this team with their two outside backs to come in as interiors, mm-hmm. okay, and playmake, if you will, and at times Sergio Des got into the final third and he looked dangerous. Anthony Robinson, not so much. But when they lose the ball, it's Weston McKennie and it's Yunus Musah out of position, and that ball is immediately coming. It's De Roon. It's Frankie de Jong immediately coming down the heart, down the spine of your defense. And it's an immediate opportunity for the Netherlands team. It's an immediate opportunity for Memphis Depay. It's an immediate opportunity at the goal of Matt Turner. It was just very naive. Mm. Very naive that you could think that going into a game with a team like the Netherlands, you were going to have more quality on the ball. They let you have it.
Yeah.
They disguised that possession for you. And yes, you had an early opportunity with Christian Pulisic, but this pretty much went down the way that Louis van Gaal had envisioned it.
So it feels like 3 hours ago now, but the first 10 minutes of the game, from a U.S. perspective, I'm thinking, this is great. Pulisic has the obvious chance and misses, but it is one-way traffic.
70-30% possession.
You're thinking,
it wasn't even close.
This is exactly what the U.S. wants. You're telling me that's not what the U.S. wants, because on the counter, I mean, that goal, you got to admit, that goal from Memphis Depay, and we'll break it down a little bit later, but that came totally against the run of play. Like, wasn't the strategy effective in those first 10 minutes?
And if you look at the opportunity that Christian Pulisic has, it's almost a 50-50 ball that gets kind of whipped right back in, and he finds himself in an onside position to his own surprise.
Yeah.
And he's too quick instead of composing himself. And while Nuber has that save, and it stays 0-0. But this is exactly what this Dutch team wanted, what Louis van Gaal wanted. They wanted you to have possession, and they will pick you apart in transition. Now,
they didn't want the U.S. to be that dangerous.
Besides that, what did they have in the first half?
Robinson got in behind in the seventh minute. McKinney had a quick throw into Pulley behind. Those are in the first 10 minutes. That's all I'm talking about.
A clean look besides Pulisic. What did they have in the first half?
So
it went exactly how the Dutch wanted this to go. And they basically said, have the ball. You're not good enough to beat us.
Yeah.
We are when we can counter at pace with you. They didn't want to run with you. These guys, the Netherlands looked tired, fatigued in those final 10 minutes. And that's why I think once the kitchen sink was thrown, once you had guys coming on like Giovanni Reyna, you had Haji Wright, you had Brendan Aaronson, Yedlin now, you're getting all stretched. They're getting stretched. Yes, you had more chances at goal. Okay? Because they are tired now, but they're also picking you apart in those transition moments when you are stretched, and you can see that. The third, the fourth always look closer than the first for the U.S. That's a reality. The third, the fourth of Netherlands always look closer than the first. If it wasn't for Matt Turner, this game would have been over a long time ago.
You know, we're going to talk a lot about the manager, and I'm sure that he deserves a certain amount of the criticism, but we got to focus on the players here as well, because to your point, I think we saw the gap in quality, as golden of a generation as this is for the United States, and as not golden as a generation as we've been told it was for the Dutch, you still see the gap. And I think you can fairly even say we see it in those first 10 minutes. The clinical nature of Memphis Depay, and it's not just Depay, it's everybody involved in that buildup. Denzel Dumfries, when he gets into the final
player of the game,
it's not if he's going to put in a dangerous ball, it's where is he going to put the dangerous ball to.
Yeah.
And then beyond that, when we talk about the midfield, where we felt there was a clear physical advantage for the United States, you know what still matters at the end of the day? What you do on the ball, your technique, your ability. And I think generally I've always felt this about the American game, the American development system. We put a premium on big kids, right? And on athletic kids. And what you saw from this Dutch team, especially in the build-up to their two goals in the first half, is tiki-taka, ping, 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 ping. And almost, Herc, I felt like using the athleticism that we talked about with this U.S. midfield against them. You bring them in a rush, and then you're out the other side,
exactly.
And it's easy.
It's very easy. It's very easy for Frankie de Jong. And we see a player of that quality, that caliber. It looks like he didn't do a lot, but he was so influential when he did have the ball in the way he orchestrated, in the way he got players going. You spoke about Denzel Dumfries. Mm. Sergiño Dest had an opportunity to play with the Netherlands, okay?
Yeah.
Sergiño Dest is one of the better players of the U.S. men's national team. He had one of the better tournaments in this World Cup. Sergiño Dest is not playing over Dumfries.
Yeah, I mean, Pascal told us he probably doesn't even get in their 26-man squad.
And Dumfries was probably the best player on the field today.
Yeah.
And you can see when you talk about the talent level, and look, we're very proud of these players, you know, from a CONCACAF level, a CONCACAF perspective, of how they did this tournament. The way they reacted from that second half against Wales, the total performance versus a very good English team, a very emotional game in Iran, and how they handled that. It's a very young team, and you should be very proud of how they handled those moments. But you can see the evident gap in talent when it comes to the players. Sergiño Dest, one of the better players, isn't on a Denzel Dumfries level. Not right now. But it's even more evident when you look at Louis van Gaal and that resume, that CV, and his actual tactical game plan today and how he just swallowed whole Greg Berhalter.
So we criticized Tata Martino with Mexico against Argentina for not being aggressive enough. I actually thought the U.S. setup in the first half was very aggressive.
They
there
were
was
naive.
Times at the back where they left it 2-on-2 and there was just tons of space. But isn't that kind of dying as you lived? Is there not some praise there?
No, it's different. It's being naive. Listen,
is that only hindsight?
Maybe, but
like had the players look. I just want to throw a stat at you.
Where do you work?
Something you point out.
What do we do?
We break it down.
All right.
Okay.
All right. Well, what I'm trying to tell you is,
I don't believe Greg Berhalter put his attacking players in a bad spot in the first half. I think he put them in good spots, and they didn't convert.
Oh, I think he put them in a terrible position.
The attacking players.
Yes, because you have Serginho Dest and Anthony Robinson, who did not have a good game. He had a very heavy foot. He's had a heavy foot on him all tournament, even more so this tournament. I give him a ton of credit for playing on one ankle. Mm-hmm. Basically, that's what he's been doing, playing on one leg. But when you ask those two players to come in as interiors, and what I mean by interiors, and people should realize, is you're asking them to carry the ball from a wide position inside and playmake as eights, okay? And what happens there is Yunus Musah and Weston McKennie will have to evacuate that space, and they will go wide. And sometimes it looks like they're the right back or the left back, or they're a winger, so to speak, and it's Timothy Weah coming inside, and it's a lot of fluid movement. That is all good. That is great when you have the ball, and it looks very good. It looks very nice. But you know what happens if you lose the ball? The heart of that central midfield, you know where they are?
Exposed.
Next to the touchline.
Yeah,
and you know where Tyler Adams is?
On an island.
1v2. Yep. And all of a sudden, Tyler Adams has to worry about 1v2, Frankie de Jong, and Derun. And then he's got to go try to track back Memphis Depay.
Yeah.
And when he can't get there, guess what Memphis has? A free chance on goal. So what I'm trying to tell you, it was very naive. It was always going to be a game of pick your chances. You have to be very proud of how they played in certain matches in this tournament. But definitely, listen, goals change games.
Yeah.
Christian Pulisic scores that goal.
It's a different game.
Motion is different, not only for the U.S. men's national team, but for the Netherlands, and it can be a different game. But you have to be smarter than that. I think that's where I'm disappointed with Greg Berhalter in this U.S. men's national
team. The stat I was going to throw out at you at the first half before we move on to the kind of the game-changing moment, 93 touches for the United States in the Dutch final third, just 29 for Netherlands in the American final third. But to the point about quality, it's what you do with those touches. The Dutch were clinical throughout. The Americans obviously were not. Let's get to the game-changing moment, because it is the goal that in the end puts Netherlands on top in the first half, 10 minutes in. It's a beautiful finish from Depay, but for me, really, it was a beautiful build-up from deep in midfield.
Deep in midfield, Denzel Dumfries again, you know, very instrumental in the attack, and it's so difficult when you're trying to chase a player of Memphis Depay's quality, his pace. And he was brilliant throughout the game, not only just how direct he can be, but how smooth he is on the ball and his ability to turn players.
He was wide open. Who's got to be there?
He was wide open because you're telling me there's no problem with the way the U.S. men's national team played, and you're okay with Serginho Dest and Anthony Robinson committing numbers forward, but you're also asking me, why is he so wide open, right? Because other players have to commit. Other players have to do things
That
happens.
Where's Adams? Where's McKennie? Where's the runners?
Exactly.
That's a run.
Exactly. Musa and Adams are out wide, like I just told you. They're lost in that play. They're eliminated. And then you're putting center backs man per man. And Memphis Depay, I mean, so just clinical as he is, it's not a hard run.
It's a brilliant run.
It's a brilliant run. Because most forwards will look for that near post run. It's a brilliant run in the sense that he holds that run. He knows exactly where this ball is coming. It's clipped back, and he's there.
Yeah. You know, it's obviously the game-changing moment, but you could point out a million different moments. The goal that falls just before the half. Give me the player's psychology there. Because if you're the U.S. at that point, you're saying, okay, 1-0, we got a shot. But I imagine that changes not just the player's psychology, but then Greg Berhalter's halftime speech, halftime approach. Everything
the
is
moves.
Kind of, everything's
his
blown
hand,
up.
His hand is forced once that second goal
Such
comes in.
Such a dagger. Such a dagger.
There are moments that change games. One of those moments is the first goal, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But you can maintain that.
Yeah.
You can work with that. You can get players to rally and know that you're still only a goal in this. It's just, hey, one goal, you're back in it, it's tied game, nothing happens. But when you're so close to halftime, all you want to do is see it out, regroup at half, okay? We'll talk about it in the dressing room. Mm-hmm. We'll gather our thoughts, we'll collect ourselves, we'll go back out there and start anew. But when that second goal comes in right before half, it's just deflating. It feels like your soul is leaving your body. You can literally see it on the field. These players, that's a sinking feeling. And you go into halftime, and who knows what's being said, what's going on, how the coaching crew is responding, who's talking to who, who's seeing who warm up, what's going through those players' minds, what's going through Greg Berhalter's head. It all gets thrown for a loop in a matter of seconds.
So you talked about the Christian Pulisic miss. What'd you make of his performance overall? And we got, I think we got to put it in context, you know, coming off the pelvic contusion, not at 100% pretty clearly. But what did you think of his work on the field today?
He showed a lot of heart, a lot of battle. Wasn't as clean.
Yeah.
Wasn't as efficient.
He wasn't what he is.
He wasn't what he is. And you have to acknowledge
that. And what he needs
that.
To be. What he needed to be today for this team, clearly.
And we spoke about that. If anybody needed to be that man today, it was Christian Pulisic. He had that chance. He wasn't as composed as he normally is. I think he may have rushed himself. I don't know if he thought he was in an offside position, so instinct and you shoot, but he had more time on the ball than he actually realized. It's a great save in the end by Norbert. But it's something that he needed to make. He needed to score that goal. And listen, goals change games. We said this. Maybe it's a different game if he puts that ball in the back of the net.
Yeah, and I think beyond that, there was a few chances where he gets into a dangerous spot, and the final pass just didn't come off. Either it was off target or the Dutch broke it up. And again, not to pick on Christian Pulisic, but he's been the guy through the first three games for this team, and clearly maybe just didn't have that 100% that he needed in a knockout round game here at the World Cup. All right, let's call on our first guest on today's edition of Football Americas, Casey Keller, who's been a part of not one, not two, not three, but four World Cup teams for the U.S. men's national team. Casey, the U.S. out in the round of 16, your first reaction to the game that we just witnessed?
Well, I mean, I've been listening to you guys, and I think I agree with a lot of what you're saying. The idea that you were going to step into this game, press Holland from, you know, the first minute, and it was working. Look, there was points, but then there was a point where I was thinking, okay, now, press 5 minutes, drop back, be a little bit more professional here. Don't give those opportunities for guys to come sneaking in behind you. But no, they just kept pressing and pressing and pressing. And then, you know, look, it was a fantastic play that the Dutch put together to open up that first goal. But when you have players pressing, and then once that quick 1-2 touch passing puts those players behind you, there's a lot of space to be exposed behind. And you saw the difference in the match of how clinical the Dutch were in the final third. And I mean, that was really the difference. Look, you can talk all you want about the 80 yards in midfield, from 5 yards outside the 18 on both ends, but that's not where games are won. Where games are won is how you defend in one box and how you score goals in the other. And the Dutch showed you that's exactly how you get yourself into the next round, is how clinical you are both defensively and on the offensive side of things. And look, I love the way the team played, but there's a point where you just, and I heard you said it multiple times, just being a bit naive, and it seemed a bit naive at times, and they got punished for it.
Casey, you use the word professional. Dive in there. What do you mean by that?
Well, to think that you're going to press this Dutch side for 90 minutes. What I love seeing is a team that's super well organized where, okay, here's my opportunity to win the ball in the defensive third. Okay, it's not on. Okay, back up. Get good defensive shape. Now we'll keep good shape, wait for the opportunity, win the ball back, work something. Okay, put a good ball in the box, win the second ball, see if you can score a goal. Pick and choose your times. It just seemed like it was, okay, we're going to have our way with you. We're going to press you. And I don't think they quite gave this Dutch side as much respect as they deserved. I, like everyone else, don't think this is a world-class Dutch side by any means. And I think the U.S. exposed a lot of their weaknesses, particularly their athleticism. There was times when the U.S. was definitely the stronger side athletically in midfield, but then there was also those times when the Dutch were able to show their technical ability, and because of that it exposed players in poor positions because they were advanced when they probably shouldn't have been, and it's It's a learning lesson. It happens. You get exposed by good teams, and what where the U.S. was successful in this tournament was not conceding chances. That's why they got themselves to this point. They elected to be more aggressive, opened themselves up defensively, and they paid the price for it.
Yeah, to Casey's point, by far Matt Turner's busiest day, right?
Without a doubt.
Not just the saves. He had four saves, but he was busy throughout.
Without a doubt. I love that Casey used the term professional because to me, and he mentioned that there's a discipline to being professional. But don't confuse being disciplined as being defensive. Mm. You have to be disciplined in the way you attack so you don't leave yourself vulnerable for chances that the opposition could take advantage of. They were not. They were very naive, and yes, to an extent, as Casey said, they didn't respect this Dutch team maybe as much as they should have. They were very content with sitting back and saying, okay, let's see how good you are. If you can break us down, okay, but we don't think you can break us down. And guess what? We think you're actually going to be naive enough to think so and are going to leave those spaces for us to attack. And they did. I love the term professional because there's so much to it than just a defensive effort.
Right, and the stats there tell us it, right? More touches in the attacking third, more touches in the opponent's box for the United States. But again, what do you do with those touches, and then how does it leave you exposed on the other end? Casey, I want to talk about some of the big decisions that Greg Berhalter made today. Probably no decision bigger than what he did with the number 9 position. What did you think of the call to go with Jesus Ferreira, who had not played yet in this tournament?
Well, it obviously didn't work. I mean, he got subbed at halftime. So I think he was cornered a little bit because of the injury to Josh Sargent. I don't think he felt that Haji Wright was in a position to necessarily start. But we talked about this position for years. And then obviously in the build-up to the tournament and how, you know, this could be a problem going forward. And obviously it was. And in the end, he made a decision. He realized it was a wrong decision at halftime and made the change. It's hard to be critical when you really don't have the option. You're then saying, do you go with a midfield, false nine, all that? You know, now you're just you're throwing stuff against the wall and seeing what sticks. So, look, I understand why he went with Jesus Ferreira. But I think there was also a reason that was telling him why Jesus didn't play in those first three in those group stage matches, and we saw that today, that maybe Jesus, good season in MLS, but you know, up against the likes of a Virgil van Dijk and an Ake, it just was too much for him.
Yeah, Granada. It ain't Granada, Herc.
Well, not only that, we're in a Winter World Cup, so you get 1 week from the tournament starting, mm-hmm. and then you're here. So those players who are in form in the regular season will probably be the most effective players in this World Cup.
Yeah.
His last game was October 23rd versus Austin. MLS playoffs. October 23rd. And Casey mentioned it. There's a reason he probably didn't play those three group stage games. I probably would have gone back to the well if you had to use a 9, if there's no Josh Sargent, if you're forced to use an actual 9. Haji Wright. He's there. And he's playing regularly in Turkey. He's got goals under his belt. At halftime, he did what finally everybody wanted to do, that false 9. He went there. There was more chances. I get it. You're throwing everything caution to the wind. You're being more proactive going forward. But there's a reason why Jesus Ferreira didn't play in the first three games, and he was put in a very difficult position.
Yeah, so he's replaced at the half by Gio Reyna. The other subs in the second half, Aronson, Haji Wright, Yedlin, they seem to have a big impact for the United States. Casey, what did you make of us finally seeing Gio Reyna in a significant role here? He got the 45 minutes there in the second half, and really the other changes that Greg Berhalter made and how they may have impacted this match.
Yeah, it's kind of hard. I mean, look, Gio, we know the qualities that Gio has, and it was the big question mark is knowing the depth kind of on that wide attacking roles is how does Greg find either the time or the place on the field to get these guys on the pitch as much as we all would like to see them on the pitch, with Aronson as well in that conversation. And, you know, it was a surprise that he had played 7 minutes only in the opening three matches. So, He had the opportunity. I thought we saw what we saw from Gio, the quality to be able to link players, to get past a player at times, put a dangerous ball in the box. But it also was a little bit false because it a 2-0 lead on a Dutch side that was already conceding possession to the U.S., it was clear that the U.S. was going to have a lot of ball, particularly in midfield. And obviously the movement was there. You talked about then that we did see more of that false nine. And there was a lot of movement across the whole front. But when you have the quality of center backs that the Dutch have, you need that extra man to actually get in front of one of those center backs to see if you could actually challenge him. I'm going to go back to one of the big question marks before the tournament even started. Should they have brought PFOC? Should they have brought Cibicu? Was he a guy that in a game like this, where you needed another big body to be able to run in front of a bigger defender, a guy that was scoring goals to start the season in the Bundesliga, is he a guy that really should have been able to come off the bench?
Yeah, and you know what's interesting about that? The 26-man roster. It feels like you could have brought, whether it was PFOC, whether it was Pepe, you could have brought...
Pepe's a big name, right?
You could have brought another forward, and to Casey's point, you know, it's almost like Jesus Ferreira gets a start today by default, right? Sargent isn't available, and Haji Wright has literally just been introduced into this team.
Especially when you look at the players who weren't used. Maybe you thought that you would have more of a chance of using a certain player in an offensive position, a profile player, and I'm talking about a nine. I will go back to Gio Reyna actually coming into the game. I love that Gio Reyna finally came into the game. What I do not like is where Gio Reyna was occupying spaces. He was inserted into this game as the false nine. Mm-hmm. That wouldn't have been my first choice if I went false nine. It would have been Timothy Weah. And you could see it by Gio's movements and maybe unfamiliarity with the situation. He didn't exactly know how to occupy the center backs, and I get it. In case, touched upon it, Ake, Timber, Van Dijk, they're very good center backs, very high-level center backs. But Timothy Weah was busy in the first half. Timothy Weah was busy throughout the game. You put a player like that can stretch, that can come in, that could get on the ball, turn face, and maybe it frees up Gio Reyna elsewhere, whether it's on the wing or coming in centrally.
I think if we go big picture here, fans probably feel pretty good about this tournament overall.
Sure.
But we've had Casey on this show a few times. You talk about exigencia, right? Standards. I think Casey has very high standards for what he expects from this national team. Casey, right now, do you feel frustrated? Was this a missed opportunity? Or are you satisfied with what the U.S. did in this tournament?
I'm actually both. I'm definitely satisfied with what I've seen. I loved the team togetherness, the way they defended through midfield from the front. We were talking about it on FC, and really that, you know, when you look at the games, yeah, there was a couple mistakes that weren't punished, and I'll go back to that free header from Harry Kane in stoppage time. But for the most part, Matt Turner had a pretty quiet three games. Now, yeah, made some great saves today, which was nice to see, but it was a really good team effort to make sure that they kept their opponents, you know, away from their goal. Now, finding that balance then between being more offensive-minded, Herc, I know you've been talking about it, is then how can you then attack, keep yourself with good cover defensively, but then be dangerous in the attacking third? We missed a little bit of that. I think maybe we needed a little bit more from let's say a Christian or maybe a Tim Weah to be able to beat guys, keep possession deeper in, but then get runs. I think it's hard that I would have loved to have seen, you know, a couple more runs from Weston McKennie. Yes, he had the great run against England and probably should have scored where he got in the box and blazed over the top. We saw, I think, another shot today from McKennie where he put the ball over the bar. So I think that was a little bit of a disappointment, and then you're coming up against a Dutch side that was beatable. I mean, there's not many times you're going to come up against, you know, the Netherlands and know that it's a team that you can beat. And that's where I was disappointed with the way this game transpired, the way the U.S. started the game bright, but maybe a little too aggressive, got hit on the counter, But that, you guys were talking about before I came on, the daily blend goal before the half changed everything. It changed everything that Greg was probably going to do at halftime, made him have to change formations, change player personnel, and that was the killer. That was the naive moment that really is the disappointment. But big picture, very, very happy. Happy for guys like Tim Ream, who had a fantastic tournament. Happy for that midfield crew. Tyler Adams had a really good tournament. What did we talk about before the game? You needed the core of your star players to show up. They did that. And then you needed some surprises from some other guys. Tim Ream being a great surprise, played so well. Cameron Carter-Vickers coming in and having a really, really good game against Iran. And then you've talked about Weah. You talked about Pulisic had a good tournament, I think, without really, knowing. But we know he can give this side more. But overall, super happy.
You could be satisfied with what you saw in the group phase and still disappointed because of what Case just mentioned. It is an opportunity missed, an opportunity lost that you probably will never have back. You probably will never have this type of opportunity versus this type of Netherlands. A Netherlands that looked very beatable in the group phase.
Just generally in the round of 16.
In the round of 16.
Very many games that you feel are accessible. And I feel like a lot of people thought this was accessible, but maybe we were overstating that. I mean, we saw a clear gap between the two sides, didn't we, today?
Well, it's not that we were overstating it, because it'd be one thing if it was just Casey saying it, if it was just you saying it, or if I felt that way. But the overwhelming response from everybody, all our colleagues here, all the pundits around us, was, and even Pascal, who's from the Netherlands, was, this is a very tight game, and Netherlands is very beatable. The U.S. can beat them. The U.S. has quality enough to beat them. But I think that quality was based on the fact that they were so good defensively and they were so lethal in transition. They picked their moments, and that was not the U.S. men's national team we saw today. They got stretched, their shape was out of whack, and they got hurt by some very good players. And you got to put some respect on that orange machine.
Let's talk about the coach. Casey, you obviously have a long-standing relationship with Greg Berhalter, and you said something very interesting the other day on this show. You mentioned that he may want to pursue something different than the national team for another 4 years through 2026. He loves working with players every day. Maybe there's a return to the club game. Maybe in Major League Soccer. Maybe this could boost his profile internationally. Maybe he could get another opportunity in Europe. But Casey, I'm going to give you the job of U.S. Soccer Federation president. I know it's not one you want, but I'm going to give it to you for this hypothetical. Would you offer Greg another 4 years through 2026 based on this World Cup? Because I feel like for all that happened in qualifying, at the end of the day, when we judge international managers, we got to judge him off the World Cup. Has he done enough for you to say, you know what, this is a guy to best prepare us for 2026 when the World Cup is going to be in the U.S. and, of course, Canada and Mexico as well?
U.S. soccer had set two goals for Greg Berhalter. First to qualify, second to get out of the group stage. When you achieve both goals, it's kind of really difficult to then not think that they deserve another opportunity if they want it. And that's obviously, there's always going to be criticism. And what's nice is the reason why there's criticism is because our squad depth is strong enough now that you actually can say, are you sure this guy shouldn't have been called into the squad? This guy should have been played. Should we play this formation? If you don't have the squad depth, that's not even a question. But in the end, what you do with the squad to be able to achieve your goals, that's all you can ask. And Greg achieved those. Now, you also have to look into some of the questions that we talked about the last time. There hasn't been a lot of success lately on the second go-around. Do you want to, as a young manager, do you want to tarnish the good work you did here with possibly issues in the future? I know that's always hypotheticals are hypotheticals, right? But that's what we're kind of paid to talk about at times. And so, the only person you can really ask is Greg, and I'm sure he's going to have a long debrief after this. He's going to do some soul searching within himself, within the family. see what, obviously, if there are options, right? I mean, we don't know. I mean, obviously, unable to leave U.S. soccer, you're not going to just resign probably and hope somebody comes knocking. There's got to be offers and able to see if they make sense and weigh things up after that. But I think Greg has done the job that he was asked to do. And with a really young group of players, we saw some very good things in this World Cup. And what's great, and I'm going to say this is a good thing, is the disappointment knowing that maybe there could have been more. Let's go back to the Belgian game where Tim had the great game and they hung on for dear life. That was a hanging on for dear life. The U.S. was in this game all the way besides a couple mistakes that showed some naive defending, some naive just approach. But at 2-1, the Dutch did not want to go into the end of this game 2-1, and that's why I think we were all devastated when that third goal came. But it was not a hanging on for dear life as a team just pummels your goal and your goalkeeper just keeps getting hit in the head with the ball. So, I mean, this was a good performance, and it's nice that it leaves you disappointed, and that shows you where the program's going, that you can play against a Netherlands in a second round of the World Cup and be disappointed.
Berhalter 2026, Herc. Does he get your vote?
He achieved both goals. He qualified, and he got them out of the group. Does he get my vote for 2026?
Because it's a different question, right? We can say he was successful this time around without giving him the job for the next 4 years.
No, he doesn't get my vote of confidence.
Really?
2026... all these players will be 25, 26 years old.
In their prime, beginning of their prime.
In their prime, playing a World Cup at home. I can't sit here with a straight face and tell you that I think Greg Berhalter is capable of taking this team on a deep run then. If I can't answer that question, he shouldn't be the coach.
Casey, real quick to you, because we've mentioned some of the U.S. failures, right, with hiring a coach for a second cycle. We can look at Jurgen Klinsmann, didn't survive his second cycle. We can look at Bob Bradley, didn't survive his second cycle. We can look at Bruce Arena, whose second World Cup is much worse than his first World Cup. But I can also, as we have on this show before, point out that there are examples of countries that have stuck with international managers for a long time and had great success because of it. Specifically, I'm thinking Spain. Specifically, I'm thinking Uruguay. Generally, Casey, when we talk about a potential 8-year tenure at the international stage, do you think that's a good idea? Is that the correct way to go? Or do you think the lifespan of an international manager should be just the 4 years and hit the reset button?
Yeah, I personally think that it's more of the latter, that you have a time with a group of guys and then it becomes repetitive. You know, the difference with a club situation is there's always new faces coming in because you're always buying new players and players are leaving and it's kind of a different locker room all the time. The national team, you're pretty much stuck with the group of players you have. And so it becomes the same thing over and over and over again. And I think that's why sometimes it's nice to have a different voice. Now, you talked about how young this group is, and what you also can't have is that complacency with a young group that's 4 years older, now thinking, okay, I was this coach's favorite player at this stage, now I can just cruise into the next one. So sometimes having to prove yourself to a new coach all over again is also a new motivational factor. So yeah, I think there's pros and cons for both. But I think let's look at Belgium. Obviously, Roberto Martinez has been there for a while. It obviously didn't go well for them. And there is sometimes that new voice for both things. Maybe for an older team that has gotten complacent. And then, you know, a group of players that has been successful with one manager. You know, that's the tough part about this, guys. There is no right answer. There's no wrong answer. It's simply trying to figure out what's the best scenario. And then the other side of it, too, for U.S. soccer, is then what are the options if either Greg chooses to leave or you choose to go in a new direction. So just to change for the sake of changing, you know, obviously they made the decision on Bob Bradley because Jurgen Klinsmann was available. If I don't see after the success, but then again, Bob very successful in South Africa, getting out of the group stage. So, yeah, U.S. Soccer has shown that they're not afraid to make a difficult decision at times. But yeah, I think a lot of it will depend on the options of both Greg Berhalter and what the Federation thinks. But let's be honest, when you don't have to qualify, I don't know how many managers want to come in. You talk to a lot of managers. Do they want to come in 4 years for a side that doesn't have to qualify and you're stuck playing a bunch of nothing friendlies until, you know, if that move is going to be made, it would probably be made a year out, a year and a half out.
It's a great point. Casey, thanks so much for your perspective. I got to cut you loose, but I'll see you in about 6 hours on ESPN FC. And generally, thank you so much. You've been a huge part of our coverage here on Football Americas. I know we dragged you out of bed there on
always
West Coast time, but you are
pleasure,
the man.
Guys. Yeah.
And we really
appreciate
it.
West Coast time. Come on, guys. I didn't even have a time to shave, you know, so you got the worst part of me. But next time, I promise, I'll shave. So thanks,
we'll
guys.
Take it.
Hey, at least you didn't oversleep like some people here.
That would be you.
Yes, I have had that happen to me here in Qatar. Just once. Let's go big picture here. Because I feel like in this moment, it U.S. fans might be feeling down. But if you look at everybody else in the region, they're feeling worse because they went home in a group phase. I'm talking about Canada. I'm talking about Mexico. I'm talking about Costa Rica. So in this kind of never-ending conversation of who is the giant of CONCACAF, the most important measuring stick is the World Cup. Has the U.S., after seemingly at least reaching Mexico with the Nations League and the Gold Cup and qualifying success as well, has it overtaken Mexico now as the true giant of CONCACAF?
So this is what us Smurfs are doing now. We're arguing over who's taller.
Exactly. This okay. World Cup, it does feel like that, yeah.
Well, just in general, because CONCACAF, I think you can see it by the numbers left in the World
Cup. But you
got
to compare yourself to your neighbors, right?
Fair. In that sense, the U.S. men's national team in this moment are the kings of CONCACAF.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even think it's debatable.
Right.
Won the Nations League, CONCACAF Nations League, won the Gold Cup, last man standing, only team to make it to the knockout round in a World Cup. Most players in Europe, highest profile players.
Mm-hmm. Youngest pool of players.
Highest ceiling.
So that's where I want to go next. Because I feel like the giant of CONCACAF can change.
In the 2000s, just as much history as any other nation in CONCACAF.
I feel like it can change week to week almost sometimes, right? Like when U.S. beat Mexico in the Nations League final and then Gold Cup, we said, okay, U.S. is on top. And then Canada finishes first in qualifying and we kind of even threw them into the mix. Do you feel like the U.S. now has established themselves as such a giant of CONCACAF that the gap to everybody else or the gap to specifically Mexico is enough that it'll last the next 4 years? Or do you think Mexico, with all the problems that you talked about last time, because I think that's the real competition we're still talking about here with all due respect to Canada, do you think Mexico is anywhere near being able to regain the edge that we would have said they had not all that long ago, probably 2019 pre-pandemic?
Absolutely, and I think because of the U.S., and their success, Mexico would hit that restart button quick, would refresh things. El Mundial tiene una nueva novia, right? They see what's going on with the U.S. right now. They don't want to let it happen. They've got just as much resource as the U.S. when it comes to football and their culture, mm-hmm. when it comes to the federation. If there is a change, a shift in mentality, they can do things just as well as the U.S. men's national team.
Even
Canada.
Right, but for specifically Mexico, do you believe that they will? And do you really believe that
not
this
in the most
is
recent.
That motivation?
Not in the recent. Maybe 3 years from now, they're going into the World Cup and you're thinking, yeah. Hey, something changed.
We did see
But from now until that 3.5, almost fourth year, because it's going to be 3.5 until the World Cup, they don't have the U-20 World Cup, yep. and they don't have the U-23 tournament, which is the Olympic Games. So that's going to be something that will hamper them because they don't have World Cup qualifying.
Yeah.
So where do you introduce this new generation? They also don't have players under 23 in this World Cup, which means they won't have a U-26 player with World Cup experience in 2026. They are behind the eight ball. But in terms of a footballing country, in terms of technical ability and how they produce players in Liga MX, because that's what they have to rely on, they're a factory of production when it comes to players of a certain age. They just don't graduate them.
Yeah, and they're not, you know, they're a factory, but a factory that doesn't sell any of its product is also the point, right? And Liga MX came out with a statement after Mexico crashes out saying, we are committed to the success of the national team.
We will analyze was a statement.
Is that them saying, hey, we're going to start selling players abroad even when it may not be for the most money? Because that's really the sacrifice that the Mexican clubs need to make. They know they can turn to Rayados, Tigres, Chivas, and sell for big money, bigger money than they can sell to some team in Holland or some team in Belgium or some team even in the lower tiers of Spain, Germany.
There are a few organizations or groups, I should say, within Mexican football that want to change things. Mm-hmm. But until the majority want to, it's going to be the same thing. And producer Beto whispered in my ear right now the amount of foreign players in Liga MX, and people often take issue with that. What do you mean foreign players? That should increase the value. Well, if you look at the Premier League, it does increase the value for the domestic player because these foreign players of a certain weight, a certain category, they have to have a certain percentage to get a work permit to play in the Premier League. That's not the case with Liga MX. You can play in any national team in the world, regardless of how good or bad that national team is, and have a spot there. That's not the case in the UK. In the UK, you have to have a certain weight, you have a certain category to increase the benefit.
Resume. Exactly.
Certain resume, certain CV.
Hi, this is ESPN's Mike Greenberg, and ESPN Bet is ready to take you through all the biggest sports moments this spring. The official sports book of ESPN has exclusive offers and markets from Scott Van Pelt, Stephen A. Smith, and me. From the playoff intensity to finally getting out to the ballpark, there's no better time for sports fans. Sign up today, and new users get $100 in bonus bets for making any sportsbook bet. Download ESPN Bet today. What a play.
Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply. See app for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your favorite sports podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music, included with your Prime membership. Amazon Music offers the most ad-free top podcasts. Enjoy shows like First Take, Pardon the Interruption, and The Low Post, available ad-free and uninterrupted. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or go to amazon.com/ESPN pods. That's amazon.com/ESPN pods to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Speaking of resumes, few folks at ESPN have a better CV than Alexis Nunez. And she joins us from live outside Khalifa International Stadium as we take a look Greg Berhalter's knockout stage loss. Oh, it's not as bad as 1934 when they lost 7-1 to Italy. Speaking of Alexis, she is with us. She's been with us throughout this tournament here on Football America. As we were on ESPN FC earlier, Alexis, you were painting the picture pregame. Paint it for us postgame now. I'm sure the mood is very different.
Yeah, guys, the mood is definitely different. It's just such an unfortunate end to what started out as a very exciting day. And you know me, as I am the Football America's vibes queen, I want to bring you the vibes, but even I'm feeling the somber mood here as the U.S. fans just stroll out in silence from the Khalifa International Stadium. And look, like I said, we got here really early, about 2 p.m., 1:30 p.m., so to speak, in the hot desert sun, and there were already USA fans here getting ready, getting excited, taking their photos, just soaking in the moment. And like I said, I got to speak to them as per usual. And it wasn't necessarily just a hopeful vibe, because I think we're all always a bit hopeful when it comes to our countries in World Cups, no matter the challenge ahead of us. But it was actually a very slightly confident, not a cocky vibe, a very confident and appreciative vibe that what they had seen from the USA up until this point suggested that they had everything it took to get rid of this Netherlands team. And I mean, we saw last night on Football America's, we had our ESPN Netherlands colleague Pascal Camperman, who spoke about how over in the Netherlands they also had reservations, not just of this tournament, but of this Netherlands team as well. They hadn't really impressed. We heard Craig Berhalter early on our ESPN FC pre-show before the match today say how we're used to some big, glitzy names from the Netherlands. And right now, we're kind of relying on the likes of a Memphis Depay, who has been questionable for club as well as for country. Well, today, he showed up. And Pascal even said he was only expecting about 2,000 to maybe 3,000 maximum Netherlands fans here today. And it's true. They were absolutely outnumbered inside that stadium by the U.S. fans. I couldn't even hear them really as much when the goals scored and when Haji Wright's ball went in. Even though it was a lucky goal, it was absolute scenes and limbs. You definitely heard from the U.S. fans there. And that is what the atmosphere was like. And I just keep thinking to myself, what if that early Christian Pulisic chance went in? Because as the boys ended up looking a bit shell-shocked once the Netherlands got their first goal, the crowd kind of went down as well. They weren't singing as much. It was nothing like what we experienced in that match against Iran. We saw even Christian Pulisic going to take a corner later on in the game, and he was kind of riling them up, telling them, come on, guys, just still keep the faith, keep believing in them. And I think I understand them as well, because you'd remember from the international break in the USA's match against Saudi Arabia just before this World Cup, I had the chance to speak to Christian Pulisic following the match, and there were so many questions about Greg Berhalter and what he really wanted to do with his team with so many great players, what their true identity was like. And I asked Christian that, and he said, you know what? I just want us to be a really nasty team. I want that when we play other teams, we leave a bit on them. We're really hard to break down. That when they see, oh, you have to play the USA, they're like, oh, geez, let me get ready for a physical battle. And we had seen that, I think, to a good extent up until today. Our good friend Nader Manua, he was sat beside me, and when he was talking about the Netherlands, he said, you know what, Lex, with all due respect to the U.S., but it looked like men that just dealt with the boys. And that's how he kind of puts it down to. And the Netherlands, of course, their experience showed up in this one. We were questioning if the moment probably got to the U.S., but they seemed a lot easier to break down than what they had pretty much put out so far this tournament. Fans wanted to see more of how they were against England, but of course it comes down to being and having that killer instinct in that final third. Now, speaking to a lot of the fans outside of the stadium as well, getting some reaction, a lot of them actually seem proud and happy that the USA were able to compete with the best, but they really are lamenting that this was a Netherlands that was there for the taking, at least on paper, at least with all the rumors, and at least as how they were playing. They were there for the taking, and they're just kind of lamenting that in the final third, they didn't have that extra fierce power to get the job done today.
So Alexis mentioned something there we haven't really covered yet, and that's the Haji Wright goal. Did he mean to, Herc?
He meant to be dangerous.
Right.
That's all that matters.
Right.
As a nine, that's all you can ask for. He got his goal. He put his team somewhat back in this game. It was 2-1 at that point, and you felt like there could be a wave pushing them forward, but too little too late.
Yeah, I got just a couple detail questions here for you, Alexis. I want to know specifically what you feel like the percentage split was between U.S. and Dutch fans. And then I'm wondering if you could tell me about the reaction when the fans finally realized that Gio Reyna was coming on, because it's a halftime sub. And I know when you were talking to fans before game, we even saw the video, they were chanting, Gio, Gio, Gio. They really wanted to see him before the game. So what did they do when they finally saw him on the field?
Oh, finally. I think even I let out a scream when I finally saw him on the field. Nadim went to get me a bottle of water, and when I came down, I was like, who's that tall boy I'm seeing? Is that Gio Reyna? And I was like, oh my God, it's Gio Reyna. And then the kid behind me, he got up and he was like, that's Gio Reyna. And I was like, yes, finally. Everyone was so excited finally to see Gio Reyna. Look, I got a lot of love for my boy Jesus Ferreira as well. I was excited to see him on the team sheet. What a story for him. And we know he's young, but I don't think anybody, even with his experience, wants to go up against the likes of Virgil van Dijk and his experience. But Gio Reyna just always adds something to it. And we finally got to see it. And we kept talking about what you guys kept saying, the fact that he's been kept out for some time now. Is this anger going to fuel him in this match? So everybody actually was really excited to see him. There were a ton of Gio Reyna shirts in the crowd. And actually, like I said, the Netherlands fans definitely were outnumbered in this one, even though you usually do see them, because nobody can miss the bright orange colored shirts. But the USA absolutely outnumbered them. I would definitely say maybe 70-30, because there were actually a lot more neutral fans today than than I even expected. And each of them kind of had to pick a side. And there were two tents outside of the Khalifa Stadium that were giving away free flags to anyone. You either had the Netherlands tent and you had the USA tent. And we went over to the USA side and they said, sorry, babes, but we've been out for like the past hour. People, all the neutral fans were grabbing the USA flags. There were only Netherlands fans' flags left for this one. So a lot of people came in there definitely rooting for the USA. And even when the names were being read out on the monitor for the team sheets and the lineup, Christian Pulisic got a massive cheer from everyone, including a lot of Netherlands fans who admittedly always will recognize him. But they said that they've got to know a lot more of the names today, especially Tyler Adams.
There it is. Alexis Nunes, as always, great to have you with us here on Football Americas. We really appreciate your presence and all that you've brought to the show through this U.S. run, helping us out with our Mexico coverage as well. We can't tell you enough how much we've enjoyed it. Thanks again.
Cheers, guys. See you soon.
10 seconds on the clock. How many things can you name that are always growing? Your relationships, your skills, your customer base. How about businesses on Shopify? Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/network, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/network now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/network.
Alexis Nunes, always bringing the vibes, as she says.
Vibes and eyes.
On Football Americas. Great to have her and the perspective that she shares there. All right, so the U.S., Herc, is not great when it comes to coming from behind. And, of course, today they fell behind by 2 in that first half. But really, Herc, in soccer, who is all that good at coming from behind? That's a tough thing to do.
Well, apparently not the U.S.
Yes.
0 wins. It's very difficult. You're chasing the game. Usually you're playing against better opposition in World Cup, especially World Cup knockout rounds. Very difficult to fault the team for not being able to be the first team to come back and win. But that's usually how it is. That's usually how it goes. I will remind you, 2010, the U.S. men's national team became the first team not to lose in World Cup history after going 0-2 down. So
there you have it. They go down 2-0 today, get one back from Haji Wright, and then in the end, a third goal, and that's the final score as we take a look at the updated brackets. Oh, what could have been a U.S.-Argentina quarterfinal. The golden generation against Lionel Messi will not be.
Get this man on straight.
Thrilled to welcome into the show Juan Carlos Osorio, El Profe, who joins us now for a tactical breakdown of what we just witnessed. Profe, thanks for your time. We'll get into the board here in just a second. But I want to start with what you often look at first when we start talking about a game, and that is the lineup. It's a statement of intent from the manager, specifically the decision from Berhalter today to use effectively his false 9 option. What is the intent? What was he telling us with that decision?
Welcome para to everybody. I do think that the idea with that false 9 was for him to, in this case, right, let's go to the board, to drop off and or descend and try to make numerical advantage in the middle third and in the central channel. Aside from that, the way the game developed, and at times it was like a man marking in the middle. You remember it was the middle third were the Jon, the Roon, and Klaassen, and sometimes they would just take the 3 man to man. And many times Adams ended up playing ahead of the 2 other inside midfielders. Now, that didn't happen. I never saw the number 9 really dropping off and try to play as a 4th central midfielder. So the idea for me was to keep the ball, earn possession. The problem with that is that then you only have the white players, in this case Pulisic and
Weah.
And Weah, to try to make to get in behind their defenders, because they decide to give the two central central defenders a lot of time on the ball. So this is basically what happened. So we have a lot of the ball. I mean, United States have a lot of the ball going this way, and I think not too much rim, but Zimmermann has a lot of time on the ball, and as they progress, there was too many continuity passes.
Continuous passes, yeah.
No, it's like a type of pass where you only look to continue with the next pass, but no progression and no penetration.
Yeah.
And not like fixing passing, where, let's say, from one center back to the opposite winger.
Do you think Van Gaal singled out Walker Zimmerman as a focal point, let him have the ball?
I think so. Knowing what I know about him, I think he did that. I think he probably concentrated on let the two center backs have the ball and not worry too much about them. But let's go back to, because I really want to make this point. So let's say he has the ball, the goalkeeper has the ball, and they do man marking. The things, if you look at it in this from up above, then you can say that despite of what a lot of people say, that the structures or the systems are just telephone numbers, I disagree. Because when you match up different systems, then you have to understand that the opposition is a facilitator, because it's giving you a space, but you have to see, you have to be able to read where the space was, and the space today was in this inside.
For who was it in?
Half
for
a
who,
spaces.
Probably. For who?
Right. Now I will go to that. Because they played, we knew they would play with three in the back plus the wide, the wing backs.
Yes.
But we didn't know if they would play with the two and three forwards to spread the defenders, but they didn't do that. They put a class in here,
yep,
as a media punta, was a number 10, and they put the two strikers together. Sometimes the pie will go there and they move, or the other way around. But it was always a space, and most of the time the space was here. Now, who can use that space? Let's say the goalkeeper goes into the fullback, so now we have Robinson on the ball, and Pulisic brings this wide wing, the wing back all the way down. Now he can go inside to the point where he has the right arm has to come with him, so create that space.
Correct.
For the number 9 or for the number 7. I mean, for the striker, I mean, or for the winger, in this case, Pulisic, or
Ferreira.
But that didn't happen. If we go on the other side, then it would be a similar situation. Then Weah can push the wing back all the way. This stays man-to-man, as we said. And then he can come here, bring this guy, or the drone, you say?
Yes.
Drone into you, and facilitate or generate this space. In the worst case scenario, I think the number 9, even if he doesn't drop, he has to, and this is trainable, if the balls go to the left, what he has to do is don't make this run, because he will follow, but offer yourself, let him see you, so he will follow. So you attract the side, and you open this space for him to go here, and even from the opposite fullback getting here, that would prevent from the counter attacks, because don't forget that we stay here 2v2.
Yeah. Prof, let me ask you a question.
Now, let me finish with this, because there might be people who can say there are other things that the U.S. could have done. Yes, they could. When Robinson is in the ball, Pulisic can come in this intervalo, and he can come here. But the problem with that is then, for the wing back, it's too easy, because he only has to read this ball, and it's a straight run to get him to close him down. And what you want is to create chaos among the defenders. That's why I prefer this way, the wingers wide open, they attract the fullback, and now the fullbacks are the ones that they are the outlet ball for the U.S. national team. And I have it here in the statistics. Many, many times they did that, those coming in here and got the ball. And the idea is to get it from the semicircle and inside the penalty spot. And from here he can play out to the winger, he can play to the number nine, he can do whatever. But many times he will miss out. They didn't read it as well as with Robinson. And I was talking to Hercules, and he was saying he doesn't like to do that too often, because then the space is here. Yes, but you have to you keep this guy busy, and he is 2v2. By the time they play the ball, we can come, and the fullback on the other side can do this, and it's 3v2.
Prof, if I may, if we can put these players, these center backs right here, man to man, there we go. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this ball over here. And oftentimes what I was seeing is Sergiño Dest drive the ball in here, okay? And Weah would try to occupy as high as he can, but he would come in as Sergiño Dest came wide with it. And I saw Weston McKennie all of a sudden here when this ball comes this way.
I saw that.
Now, my problem here is there's a space when the ball gets lost. Yeah. And it's a very direct line into the midfield or directly to Memphis, who's 1v1. With Walker Zimmerman. And we saw that oftentimes in the first half. Yeah. The constant need of the outside backs to play as interiors, whether it's Robinson or Sergiño Dest, forced Yunus Musa or Weston McKennie wide, and it just left this man, Tyler Adams, on an island. So Tyler Adams starts here high, and he's forced to make 40-yard recovery runs, and the ball ends up this way and then back here. He can't chase him, and then into the goal.
I was watching the block with Casey Keller, and I think he was talking about discipline, and Hercules make a point about knowing how to attack. Well, the problem is that attacking, well-organized attacking football, but what they in the Spanish call football de ubicación,
right,
means that we don't want this to happen. Let's go back to this one. What Hercules is saying, he's right. You don't want the fullback to come here and you inside midfielder ended up there. What you want is that he try to bring all, he does this, he makes this run and see what he does. Most likely he will come here. And that's advantage for us, because, or for the Americans, because then you have a Klaassen following the fullback, and he will not do that. Right. He won't be able to live with his pace. You saw that even the fullback struggled with his pace. So the same thing on the other side, and they have the most athletic players out wide.
Correct.
So you have to make this run. He has to make this run and keep the back three right here, deep into their side. But they didn't do that, perfect. And we end up doing what Hercules said many times. It was McKennie there or
Musa
here, and we were wide open. We just didn't connect well enough.
So the first 10 minutes before the goal falls felt really good. If you're a U.S. fan, you're seeing the team have a lot of the ball. You see a really good opportunity. And then right around 10, 15 minutes in, it felt like the game started to change. The game plan started to go more and more the Dutch way. They seemed to have more and more control. From a managerial standpoint, what changes could have been made? What would you have done in that situation? Would you have waited until halftime? Would you have changed tactically something at around 30 minutes? Because it really felt like from a great start, the U.S. fell off a cliff almost.
I think in football, at the top level, There are many times you can come back from a 2-0 down, but there are not too many in the World Cup that come down, that come back up, or they get their lives back after you are...
There's only one, actually, and that was in 2010.
Exactly. So the first goal dictates everything. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we mentioned this in this program, but yesterday was a debate about that. And my point was, I can see the Dutch team with a better chance to score in United States than United States on the Dutch. But it was the other way around. I was wrong. Pulisic has the best chance.
Yeah.
And you put that away.
It changes things, right?
It changes the whole thing. Because then you force the back three, not the wing backs, their back three, Van Dijk and...
Timber, Ake.
Yes. Timber and Ake. And I don't like to push that line too higher up because they know they will struggle with pace. Mm. So the first goal dictates everything. And then... the game just goes on. There is nothing between the 15th and the 30th minute. But then we, United States, concede that second goal at the 45th minute plus, just before half break. And that kills that forced the manager to make other substitutions.
So, right. Give me that perspective, right? Because you're probably, as a manager, at 1-0. You've got your plan. You know what you want to do. And then, boom, the goal literally falls second before the half. Mentally, are you scrambling? Like, does that have to change exactly what you're going to do at halftime and maybe the changes that you were going to make? Because I think at 1-0, maybe you could wait till the hour mark. But at 2-0, it felt like you better do something now or it's going to be over.
I would be very clear because I have done it in the past. The first half, you play close attention to the systems and where the space is. And obviously, top managers or top coach sees that during the game. But you can enforce that with the technology now. You show 2 or 3 clips at halftime to the players in the board because that everybody's available to do that. And you point it out. And I would have a substitution in the middle third because none of them were making profit. These runs.
Where would you have subbed?
Here. Probably this type of players, they're making these runs that I spoke about because we needed, United States needed to push the back three back.
Okay, so your message would have been different. You wouldn't have changed the player. Your message would have been different.
Different, and if I do have a very athletic player, as athletic as Musa or Makini, I would probably have done,
would make a change. Pin him back a little.
Because I don't think what I have seen from the United States, the two central defenders can change anything. Because the one thing that they didn't do, the central defenders, were to run with the ball like Thiago sometimes does.
Thiago Silva.
Yeah, Thiago Silva, or top defenders.
Correct.
Rodrigo. The center back for Spain. Yeah, Rodrigo.
Yeah.
Now he plays as a central defender, and he runs with the ball, and that invites the opposition to come, liberates one player, and then you fix whoever comes, and your next pass is right then. But I would, to go into your question, I would make clear that we need those deep runs and push all the Dutch team back here. Even for the strikers, they would be higher up to the pitch, because I think they show some signs of being tired.
Yeah, I think the Dutch showed signs last 15, 20 minutes.
And
the U.S. as well.
Too.
Oh, that could be as well. Frankie de Jong was instrumental, and I kind of had him being one of those instrumental players. Who I didn't have being instrumental was Denzel Dumfries.
Oh, my goodness.
He was so good, probably the best player on the field. Why was this player here so effective with and without the ball?
I think he won his athletic battle with him.
With Christian Pulisic?
I think so. And you are absolutely right. I think he was the most influential player. He has 2 assists and scored a brilliant goal with his left foot, and he's a right-footed. And when you have the 2 wing-backs scoring goals because De Bruyne scored the second goal, then you have to really question who was in charge or who was...
missing an assignment,
The guy who was marking him.
Yeah.
They didn't have anybody. If they have a winger here, then I can understand that. But credit to the Dutch, they do playing, and in the first goal is a master of class how to get out of that pressure, yeah, playing one-touch football, because the U.S. didn't go at a time, and that's what I said. There were signs of being a little tired, because when you go one by one, it depends on how you're feeling. When you go all together, it's because you feel fresh and you just follow whoever goes for the ball.
Question for you. We've talked a lot about Mexico on this show, and Tata Martino, the manager, got criticized a lot for what he did against Argentina, right? He wasn't aggressive enough. As a fan, if I'm a U.S. fan and I watched the first half of this game, I said, boy, this team is being very aggressive, and I kind of like that. And yet when we hear the analysis from Hercules, when we hear the analysis from Casey, they use the word naive. Was the U.S. approach in that first half naive? Did they not show enough respect to this Dutch side?
I don't know if the U.S., because only Mr. Berhalter can answer that. If they have played in the back with at some points, I would probably go with a 3-4-3 and just have the keep the advantage on the flanks, reduce the amount of inside midfielders, and now I will go wide all the time and just play 2 versus 1.
You really like the mirror, well, right? At least the three at the back. Why is that so important?
Because at the end of the day, it's man-to-man, really. And you have the advantage in your defender, in their defensive zone. And you have 3 versus 2 for their counter-attacking, because they play very good, very effective counter-attacking game. But you keep the 4 versus... Now you have 4 midfielders, because you have wide players that could be your fullbacks, maybe 2 central midfielders and more athletic players, and you play with 3 up front, and you just keep going forward.
Let me ask you about Van Gaal. You obviously know Van Gaal. Yeah. You've seen his style. You've seen his mannerisms, how he presents himself to the people. He seems like a no-business type of individual. When everybody's talking about the U.S.'s chances against the Netherlands and how they like their chances versus the Netherlands, how this Netherlands isn't the Netherlands of the past, how these players aren't the Van Bastens, the Bergkamps, the Van Persies, the Van der Sars of the past. The way he set his team up, what did it tell you? Did it tell you, like, oh, okay, come at us and we'll show you how good we can be?
Well, I have the privilege to have seen all their games, and they play against Ecuador, they play the same way. Against Senegal, they play the same way. I didn't see the third game.
Qatar.
I didn't go to that game.
But you did good.
No disrespect to anybody, but they just play to score the first goal, and after that, they just control the game and pass it until they kill the game, basically. Right. They kill the opposition. So good reaction to U.S. when they got the game they score and they put 2-1. But again, it shows that they have quality enough we need one more goal, we go for it. And then after that, it's no problem. But finally, I would say, because a lot of teams don't like to play the mirror system. So my final and last suggestion is, if that's the case, like today, you want to fix the back five, you need 4 players. So you start with a 4-2-4. No 4, or you have your best 2 central midfielders, you add another striker, and you play 2 in the central channel against the 3. So it changes like that, right? So this will be the structure. So you have 2v2 here, you still have, this is their structure. You still have 2 versus 1. You have 2 strikers that can go here or drop to help the 2, right? Or vice versa. And he is wide and he is wide. And you still have the fullbacks to attack.
Right, and that's that engages what the arms, that's like
how
you said.
That's how Ecuador scored against the Dutch team, playing 4-2-4. And keeping Plata wide and keeping the other winger here. And this fullback, if you remember, Stupiñán has a great game going that forward, because they don't know how to mark here.
I have one last question for you. It has nothing to do with the tactics board. You've now seen this U.S. team quite a bit, right? There's going to be a discussion as to whether Greg Berhalter stays through 2026 or not. There's quite a few people, including Casey Keller, who thinks he may want to go back to the club world. Like, that's what he likes to do. He wants to work every day. If the U.S. job comes open, knowing that there's a World Cup in the United States in 2026, and knowing La Camada, the generation of players, how attractive would that job be to you?
Oh, I think it is a great job to have, or to, and a great program to be part of as a nation and as a football team. Fantastic opportunity, not just for me, for any other manager. I think it's a great, the way they compete, the Americans. Well, I went to university there, and the one thing that I learned there was that you can compete against anybody. So, for instance, the way I coach and the way I approach the game is because that, because I learned it in the States. You can compete against anybody, you're well prepared. And the other thing is the way I train, it was because I had the opportunity to watch the Chicago Bulls basketball team training, and I thought, this is back in 1990, I thought, this is the way to go. Train the game through real game situations. So I see all those aspects, and it would be a fantastic opportunity for any manager in the world, any club, any coach.
You know, from what you've seen, the eye test in this World Cup, okay, there's going to be an expanded World Cup 2026, more teams, 48 teams. How far do you think this U.S. team right now, they're all 21, 22 years old, they'll be like 25, 26 in 2026. How far do you think this team can go?
Pakistan en el próximo Mundial.
I think...
As a home nation.
U.S. has an advantage as far as who they can compete against. Even if they play from now on, knowing that they will have a place in the next World Cup, even if they play friendly games, they can choose and pick, and probably is a great temptation for any nation in the world to play in the United States versus other nation teams that can only play against medium opposition. And the only way you can make those players better is by training properly, but especially by competing against the best.
Okay.
Because there is raw, natural talent.
Octavos, second
here.
Round, quarters. Where do you see
I think
them?
They should go to even to the at least to the fifth game.
Wow.
Quarterfinal, so. At least.
Yeah. Profe, again, brilliant stuff. Incredible what you've added to our coverage here. The folks back home are loving it. We really appreciate your time. It's been great to have you with us. Right now, let's take a look at some quotes because they're starting to stream in. All the managers, all the players talking in the aftermath. And here's what we're hearing from Greg Berhalter, who had these comments about today's matchup. Quote, we don't have a Memphis Depay right now scoring in the Champions League. Okay, so very interesting right there.
Oh, he's not wrong.
Pointing out
thanks for that one.
What many would say is obvious there. But again, Greg Berhalter, and the quote is, we don't have a Memphis Depay right now who's scoring in the Champions League. Brilliant stuff from El Profe as we clear everything here on the Football Americas set. Herc, what do you make of those comments right there?
Genius. He's right.
Shots fired at the players,
no,
at the American players?
No. They also don't have a Pep Guardiola. They also don't have a Mourinho.
That's a shots fired.
No, it's not. It's the truth. And he's being honest. And I'm not taking a shot. It's just the truth. Like, what do you expect me to say? Fine. Listen, Memphis Depay is a very good player. There's a reason he's been where he's been. Okay?
They paid what they paid for him.
United, Barcelona.
Barcelona got him on a free, but they had to pay a lot.
Whatever.
To him, yeah.
You don't just play at that level if you're just some Joe Schmo. He's a very good player. And I think the quality today was evident. That's what he's trying to get at. The quality was evident. The gap in player quality was evident. But I repeat, it was also very evident in coaching. And I said many times before, as green as this team is, as novice as this team can be at times, you know who's the most green and sometimes the most naive?
I'll let you say it.
It's Greg Berhalter. You can't have it both ways. Yeah, you don't have a Memphis. You also don't have a Pep.
Is it more, let me ask this, was the gap bigger today between the Dutch team and the American team? More Louis van Gaal and Greg Berhalter?
I think Louis van Gaal and Greg Berhalter.
Really?
Yeah, because I just
want to say, Pascal Kemperman said Sergiño Dest doesn't get in that 26. I know you did a combined 11. I think that was mostly based on the tournament, but yeah, we're really
but
doing
Sergiño
an 11.
Dest was running by
how many Americans are getting in this Dutch squad?
Don't do
Dutch
that, because it's not that, Seb. It's not about comparing
that
a player man
picture
for man.
Of the gap?
Okay, so why do certain teams work well under systems and beat better teams, better players? Because
a manager can make up for those.
You can make up for those deficiencies. That wasn't the case today.
What could he have done?
Naive is one.
So pull out Tata Martino and
no.
I mean,
no.
We would have hammered him for that. We would have hammered him for that.
Did you like the way they played against England?
Yeah.
Oh, that was a professional performance, right? Why couldn't you try playing the same way against the Netherlands?
Do you think they ran out
Why
of
did
steam?
You think, yeah, a little bit of that, because it's very difficult to play, and that goes into being naive. If you know at some point, the fourth game, you're asking the same midfielders to play, one coming off an injury.
Yeah.
Okay? And Weston McKennie. You're asking Christian Pulisic after that knock, and I know it's about managing the pain, to play his fourth game. You're asking a lot of those defenders like Anthony Robinson, who's so powerful in the way he drives, but heavy-footed at times, and even more so when he's fatigued, to play that way. Yeah, you're asking a lot of them. That goes back to the coaching, being naive. The most disappointing thing about this is this Dutch team didn't beat you by overwhelming you with the ball. They beat you by being smarter than you. They beat you by sitting back and picking you apart. Who does that? Who does that? Think about that.
I mean, the best teams. The well-coached teams.
The well-coached teams.
Right.
Those are the teams that do that.
We talk about quality as it pertains to the starters, but I think quality in terms of great footballing nations is also represented in your depth. And something Greg Berhalter talked about before the tournament was how he was going to use his subs, and it made it sound like he was going to use them a lot.
Everybody, right?
Right. But in the end, when you have to go back to that midfield three, and we talked about, you know, what defines them, their athleticism. Well, after you play one, two, three, and you get to the fourth game, that athleticism is not going to be what it was in the first game. And so when we talk about, oh, the Dutch are this much better than the Americans, they also have that many more players who can come in and make
and
a difference.
Berhalter
the U.S. didn't have that depth
that.
In midfield.
And Greg Berhalter realized
especially
that.
In midfield.
Because he didn't go to the well with Luca Della Torre.
Ooh, you know? Speaking of, 99.99% sure that you said he would start a game here, and he didn't play.
He didn't play. You take great
New
pride in Luca not playing.
New shoes for
Seb. That's a little weird. You owe me the Serbia one. You lost that one.
I mean, my shoes are going to be a lot more than $50, brother.
It was
I'll tell
not
you that
50
much.
Bucks. We'll get to that later. But you look at the subs he made. You look at World Cup qualifying, what's essentially a three-game window. He would use 26 out of 27 players. The only ones who would not play would be like the third goalkeeper. So you thought he would have gone to that well, him trusting his team so much, right? He realized the level was a lot greater than he thought, or the trust was not as great as he had had. Mm-hmm. So he essentially only used Haji Wright, Jesus Ferreira, okay, for a half, Shaq Moore a few times, Giovanni Reyna, Yedlin, and Kellen Acosta. That's it, right? Who am I missing here?
Aronson.
And Brendan Aaronson.
Yeah, Brendan Aaronson got in.
But sparingly. He went with the same core. And sooner rather than later, fourth game, here you are.
Cameron Carter-Vickers got to start.
Cameron Carter-Vickers got to start. But sooner rather than later, here you are. And the gas tank wasn't full as it was.
And you needed it, that's for sure. One thing we always need here on Football Americas are your questions. And so next we head to Check the Mentions. What are the folks on social media talking about? Serge Jim asks, would Pepe or PFOC been better choices over Haji or Ferreira? Herc?
Very, very difficult to be critical of Haji when he gets a World Cup goal, right?
Yep.
But there were moments when you thought maybe a different type of player would be best suited. And today, Jesus Ferreira, which is just so crazy to me that you would count on him so much. Greg Berhalter, that was his man. If you said Greg Berhalter had one player up front that he trusted, it was Jesus Ferreira. And he only went to that well once, and it was in the most important game. And he pulls him at half. A Ricardo Pepi, in certain times, especially with Josh Sargent, who was my de facto number one, couldn't go, would have been just so crucial to you. Just in form, a player that can drop in between those lines, that could combine. A player that's gotten you out of tough spots before. Not being able to go to that, not having him here, That was difficult for me to understand.
It felt like the number nine decisions were based on profile instead of form. And we talked about it during the game. It felt like instead of Greg Berhalter bringing his three biggest hammers, he brought three different tools that he could use in different situations.
Right.
Was that the wrong approach?
Of course. Good
Hindsight's
players are good players. Again, I will remind you, this is what we do.
I know.
We work in TV, and we sit here, and we analyze. This is what we do. And, yes, knowing what we know now, more informed players, goal scorers, which are always of value, especially a guy like Jordan Pefak that's proven to score goals in many different ways and in different setups, he has value. I know you can say the form or whatever, but you just used a guy in Jesus Ferreira who the last time that he actually played a game was October 23rd in Major League Soccer. So that form that you're talking about, it'll take time to get him there, goes out the window.
Right.
So a lot of different things that didn't sit well. At the end of the day, you know, guys like Ricardo Pepi and Jordan Pefak will always be a what if.
Let's get to our next question here.
In this World Cup, I mean.
On Check the Mentions on Football Americas as we continue to wrap up the aftermath of the U.S. defeat to Netherlands in the round of 16. 3-1 the final score. Lloyd van Eunen. Maybe some Dutch roots there. Does this loss show the gap between America and the world?
Does he mean the Americas in the world? Because
that, I think that is America.
Well, I know, but
United
that
States.
Is evident because it was in this second round, Brazil, Argentina, the United States. So you can count the Americas as well, right?
And it's Let's not the world. It's the elite of the world.
The elite of the
maybe
world,
we're saying,
which is still in Europe.
Yeah, maybe we're saying we've said all along that this Dutch team isn't, like, historically elite. They're still a top 10 team in the world.
But
so
I'm
maybe
going
that's
to
the
be
question,
honest,
the gap between the U.S. and the top 10.
I do see there being a gap between the Brazils and the informed Argentinas to the rest of the Americas. Okay? And I'm going to include CONCACAF in that. CONCACAF in the Americas, not just CONCACAF. Okay? And Brazil and Argentina are as close as you can get to competing with the best in Europe. And very close. I actually think Brazil is my team to win this in this World Cup. But since there's that much of a gap between those two and the rest of the Americas, you could only imagine what the gap is to the elite in Europe.
Yeah.
Nobody, and I repeat, nobody from Brazil, Argentina down has a Kylian Mbappe type of player, has a Neymar, or even a Jared Aishkiri, who's already got three goals in his last three World Cups. If you think about that, that's a harsh reality, but it's the truth. So it's not just America that you just lump that into.
Yeah. All right, our final question here on Football Americas. La última y nos vamos. Well, not quite vamos. There's still a few more things left in the show. But let's get to the final question here in Check the Mentions. It actually comes from one of our colleagues, Jen. She was the producer of the E60 on the NWSL's 2021 year that was. Remember, she joined us on the show a couple months ago. She asked, what is worse? The fact we couldn't track back into the box and stay with our marks, giving up easy goals, or that we just don't have a clinical finisher. So many golden chances missed. Kirk, what's worse?
I think it's defending, because how innocent that defending is. I mean, you could not have a clinical finisher, and don't make that face, but you would count on Christian Pulisic to bury that one, right? You would count on your players to take their chances and the guys who take their chances to be good at taking their chances. But you can't be a good team if you let in those type of goals, those easy goals.
Yeah.
So to me, you can stay in games if you're not finishing. You can't stay in games if you're giving up those type of plays. Do you see my rationale
here? Yeah, I guess my counter to that would be we talked all build up about the lack of a number nine and how much that, you know, kind of puts a ceiling on this team. And so when you talk about finishing, I think that's, of course, Pulisic misses his chance. But if you have a clinical number nine, you know, the ceiling for this team, and if they can find that in the next 4 years, I think jumps. The thing
well,
we talked
to the coaches, because Greg Berhalter doesn't use a nine.
Okay, but we talked about, like, what the strengths of this team were, and we talked about athleticism and specifically in the midfield. So for me, that's the bigger letdown there, because that's what you knew you could count on, not just coming into this tournament, but it was reinforced through the first three games. Like, if you would have told me that Tyler Adams and Yunus Musa were going to lose their marks, and that's where the first goal would come from and get picked apart in midfield, I would have been like, oh, man, I'm going to be really let down by that, because we hadn't seen it yet to date. So I think that, to me, is maybe the bigger disappointment, just because...
Which one would you take?
I figured the
Which
number nines, and they wouldn't be clinical
Which
finishing
Which one would you
here.
Take? A clinical finisher or better defending?
If I could.
Because you lose
a clinical
one.
Finisher. It's like a quarterback in the NFL. If you can find
you're gonna
one.
Score, you're going to score a goal, but you're gonna get three scored on you.
All right, so great to check the mentions. Really appreciate everybody sending in your questions. We have just crossed the 90-minute mark here on Football Americas.
Wow.
Producer Betao telling us we are into added time, which we know in this World Cup has been very, very long. So you never know what we might get into. Actually, we're going to get into some MLS news here. The league has announced sanctions, Herc, against the Los Angeles Galaxy for violating salary budget and roster guidelines. These sanctions stem from back in 2019 when LA added Cristian Pavón to the roster as a TAM player. The sanctions, Herc, include $1 million in fine for the club, a loss of $1 million in general allocation money. Chris Klein has been suspended through May of next year. Now, you have been very critical of Chris Klein throughout his time at the LA Galaxy and throughout the existence of this show. Is this the straw that breaks the camel's back for you? Should Klein be out of the LA Galaxy?
So, can't get a good team on the field, and now you can't do the books right? Now you're purposely cheating? I mean, we crucified Inter Miami for this, right? What happened to Paul McDonough?
Suspended for a year and a half. So he was in May of 21 that he got busted or that the news came out. He was suspended through the 2022 MLS
season.
And
that was supposed to be the...
And he lost his job because remember, he'd gone from Inter Miami to Atlanta and lost the Atlanta job.
The fine or the punishment that kept everybody else from not doing it, right? Now here comes the second one and it's not as heavy. I know that Paul McDonough probably did it with five different players in Inter. But at some point, you got to ask yourself a few things. If you're the LA Galaxy, is where do you draw the line with Chris Klein? Like, when is enough enough?
Right.
And two, if you're Major League Soccer, is if teams are continually trying to break the rules, don't have those stupid rules.
I'm with you on that. I'm 100% with you on
that. Like, change things.
Right.
If they want to
be more ambitious, let them.
Let them be ambitious.
Right. There is no greater sin, Herc, in a salary cap league than cheating the salary cap, right? Because we've all come to the table, agreed to play by certain rules. Worth noting, the Galaxy, on top of all the other sanctions, can't add international players next summer. Remember, Ricky Puig, Brugman, Cáceres, they brought in a lot of guys in the summer. I'm thinking that's going to be a huge blow for the Galaxy because that summer market this coming year, I mean, it's loaded with players. If the Galaxy can't... Producer Beto saying, Luis Suarez in my ear, I hear you. If the Galaxy can't reload in the summer... I mean, that's a huge blow to this team.
You think so? Who just won MLS Cup?
LAFC.
LAFC!
What'd they do?
In your city!
They reloaded in the summer.
And now this is happening. You can't reload? Your immediate reply is, well, maybe next year?
Yeah. It seems like more and more the LA Galaxy, your former team, losing ground in the battle for Los Angeles with LAFC. All right.
Who said that?
That'll do it. Not just for the U.S. participation in the 2022 World Cup, but for this episode of Football Americas as well. We are not done, though. We are not going home. We are here throughout the rest of the tournament, and
I'm
we will be on live with you every day, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on ESPN+. For Hercules Gomez, producer Beto, the rest of our amazing, hardworking production team here in Doha, back in Los Angeles, back in Bristol. For all those good folks, I'm Sebi Salazar. Thanks for coming on this journey with us. We'll see you tomorrow, right back here on ESPN+.